start. garbage.
Yeah, there's a lot of them.
Yeah. Welcome back. Leave that door open some air.
Yeah, well, it's better to, when we have the meditation, at least we could have the rooms closed.
Om Parthaya Pratibodhitam Bhagavata Narayanena Swayam Vyasena Kakitam Purana Munina Madhye Mahabharatam Advaitam Mitavarashim Bhagavatim Ashtadashadhyayini Ambatvam Anusantadham
And chapter 17, verse
16. Manaprasada-samyutvam, manaprasada-samyutvam, mounamatma-vinigraha, mounamatma-vinigraha, bhava-samshudhira-tepat, bhava-samshudhira-tepat, tapo-mana-samuchate, tapo-mana-samuchate, manaha. Manaprasadaha, it's actually a compound, manaprasadaha, we looked at this last week. Manaprasadaha, saumyatvam, maunam, atma vinigraha, bhava samshuddhi, ityetat, tapo manasam uchate, tapaha manasam uchate. So, The manas prasadaha means that cheerfulness of mind, that prasada buddhi, really, it's a cheerfulness of mind. And the cheerfulness of mind, just to talk a little bit more about that, as really when, first of all, when dharma is more important to you, so we just kind of move inward in terms of our values. When dharma becomes more param, or parama, means more valued to you than object sense gratification. Mm. Your commitment is more to dharma. Immediately, all kinds of reasons for agitation go away, because the commitment is not to sense gratification, the commitment is to dharma, or what is called upon me to do at this moment. That commitment to dharma is really equivalent to, or the same as, the commitment to Ishvara. It means that Ishvara Arpana Buddhi, where I view everything as Ishvara, and all of my behavior really is just a worship of Ishvara. How does that operationalize? Mm-hmm. What does that really mean? How do I show that in the world, that my commitment really is to Ishvara? Well, it's because my commitment is to Dharma. Dharma really is Ishvara. It's the structure of Ishvara, you know. And so how I live in this world is really that Ishvara Arpana Buddhi, means my buddhi, the commitment of my mind, my focus, is on that worship of Ishvara, which means I am committed to Dharma. And so when the commitment is to Dharma, or the commitment is to Ishvara, another aspect comes in, which is what we call that Karma Yoga Buddhi. Karma Yoga Buddhi, really, what I mean, Karma Yoga Buddhi, what I mean is that Prasada Buddhi means that I take all of the results of my actions as prasad from Ishvara. And so just like when you go to temple and you go through the whole ritual, this is what I do when I'm in India, I go early in the morning, about 5:30 or 6, and the puja goes on. It ends around somewhere around 7. But so you go through this whole beautiful process, and at the end there's the prasad that's handed out, mm-hmm. you know? And that prasad is so sacred, you know? And you feel the sanctity of it. So when the prasad is handed out, you're happy to receive it because it's a gift from Bhagawan, right? It's Bhagawan's prasad. Mm-hmm. And it's been gone through this process of sanctification, and then this prasad comes and you receive it with what we call that prasad of buddhi. And so in that prasad of buddhi, there's only welcoming. That's a welcoming buddhi. Because no one's going to say, I don't want that prasad. I'm only getting the flower petals. I wanted the laddu. You know? I wanted the laddu. I wanted the meal. I didn't want just flower petals. And nobody thinks like that. Because it has nothing to do with the object.
Right.
It has to do with that this is something that's given by Bhagawan. You know, something that's a blessing. You receive it as a blessing. And so when the focus is on Dharma, and you have that prasada buddhi there, all in the light of your knowledge, the mind has cheerfulness. Because the understanding is your mind is naturally cheerful. That's your nature. Because the self of the mind is ananda, is Brahman. That's your being. Your being is naturally whole and complete. Your being is naturally ananda. And so when the mind isn't encumbered by these raga dveshas, by these likes and dislikes, it's just enjoying its own natural shanti, which is full and complete. It's kind of like the water bucket, the clear water bucket, how that naturally enjoys the sun shining in it as it is and penetrating through all of it. That's the shanti. That's just a natural, nobody's messing with the water. Nobody's thrown mud into it.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody's gone in and made it, you know, made it agitated. It's just the mind. It's just the water. And the water, when the water is just being, then its relationship with the sun, which is illumining it, is very resonant. There's nothing in the water, the nature of the water, which is as though putting an obstruction between the nature of the sun and the reflection of the sun. Like, say I throw some water, some mud in there. Then there's an obstruction between the luminosity of the sun and the luminosity of the reflection. Say I agitate it. Then there's some obstruction between the shanti, you know, the peace, the depth of the sun, and the brokenness of the reflection. And so we find when our mind enjoys a shanti, nothing is interfering with it. Your raga dveshas, your likes and dislikes, your unconscious material, nothing is interfering with just the shanti, the sattva of your own nature. Then the reflection, reflection in the mind is so totally resonant with your own being that your being is not competing with anything. By what I mean by competing, yourself is never competing with anything from its own standpoint. But when the self, the conscious being that you are, the fullness that you are, is illuminating a mind that is really agitated, then the agitation in the mind is its own experience. Right? The agitation experience, or the depressed experience, or the angry experience. These are states of mind, which are illumined by the sun, illumined by the self. Yourself isn't agitated or angry or depressed or anything. It's always exactly the same. But the states of mind go on changing, right? And so the state of mind, just like the body, is capable of giving so much pain. Like if you were to break your leg or, you know, even if you were to, you know, tear your fingernail, just little fingernail. It can just cause you so much pain. It's just taking all your attention. Your little fingernail or a toothache. These are problems. They take your attention. Okay? So just like the body can rob you in the sense of take your mind and focus it there. just because of the nature of the pain, the mind can do the same thing. So when the mind is hurt, the mind is agitated, the mind is angry, the mind has unconscious material coming up, the little boy inside, the little girl inside is hurting, then the same beautiful self is illumining and holding that experience. Right? For a jnani, or for somebody who, as your knowledge starts becoming clear, the self that you are becomes a beautiful refuge for that upset mind, because it's been discovered, it's been differentiated. And so the upset mind, the hurt mind, the angry mind, the little mind with all of the unconscious material, that mind has this beautiful self, your being, as its refuge. But until that viveka is there, there is no refuge. The mind hasn't differentiated its condition from the conscious being, which illumines it. And so the conscious being, the you that illumines it, it being not a refuge for the mind, it just becomes the kind of invisible air, or like the fish in water, it becomes the invisible, changeless nature that is never not there, so it's not noticed. So all the mind notices are its variety of conditions. Right? The sad condition, the happy condition, the peaceful condition, the angry condition. It's just going from one condition to another. There's no real shanti there. But once for a jnani, as you gain knowledge, all of these different conditions are taking place in shanti, in the wholeness, in the refuge of your mind. That's the condition of a mumukshu. As you're starting to gain knowledge, this is one of the things that happens along the way. You start recognizing that all of your ills, all of your problems, all of your hurts are being held by the refuge of your being. And that's a tremendous freedom. When that's so, then as the mind is more and more committed to Ishwara, just committed to Dharma, the mind itself, always enjoying the nature of the self, itself gains shanti just by the way it's behaving in the world. If your commitment in the world is to Ishwara, is to Dharma, then the raga dveshas, the likes and dislikes of I need this person to be that way, or this person to be that way, or this situation to happen in order for me to be happy, that's gone. Who cares? That you give all of that up. Now it's much different. It becomes, my commitment is to being with Ishwara, which is this, every moment is Ishwara. This is Ishwara. Being with Ishwara. And how do I be with Ishwara? I do what is to be done here. This is Ishwara, every moment. And so what is being asked of me in every moment? What is my dharma in this moment? That's what I do. And Bhagavan decides, really, what the scene is going to be, what the scene that I'm in. Bhagavan decides that. And that's your power of the karma, but in another way. And then what do? Is you do your dharma in this situation, and that's the life. You do your dharma in the situation. That gives a huge amount of shanti to the mind, because the mind no longer is concerned about raga dvesha. It's concerned about doing dharma in the particular moment, doing what is to be done in the particular moment. And then as your knowledge matures, the focus becomes even not so much on Dharma or on Ishwara, because that's become a given. It becomes more, the focus is more on enjoying the self of Ishwara, and the self which is yourself. So then the mind's focus, the Dharma is taken care of because that's your commitment. And the Dharma is taken care of, and the focus more and more is on the ananda of the self, which is the self of Ishwara. The ananda of the self, which is yourself, which is Brahman, which is the self of Ishwara. And so that mind naturally enjoys a natural cheerfulness that isn't subject to ups and downs. The cheerfulness of that prasada buddhi is not subject to ups and downs really either. Because what's going to change it? It doesn't have to do with fulfilling this desire or that desire. It has to do with prasada buddhi. It doesn't mean I don't have desires. As long as you have a jiva, you have desires. It's just that the desires you've picked up along the way as you gain knowledge, those drop off because they're not yours. We pick up all kinds of desires. Be, oh, that person's so happy, or that person's, you know, so awesome. My younger family members will say, so awesome. You're so cool. I want to be cool. So that person's so cool. So let me be cool like that, you know. Let me be awesome like that. Let me do that so that I can be awesome too, you know. That I can be far out too. But that doesn't have anything to do with you. It has nothing to do with your prarabdha. So these things that you've picked up along the way, those things drop off. Desires that don't really belong to you, they drop off. But what is left is your own prarabdha, the prarabdha that is yours. And that prarabdha, some of that prarabdha is what we call anyecha. Anyecha means what makes you move, what takes you through your prarabdha. Well, somebody needs you to do something, and they call on you, I need you to do this, or you need to do this or that. Other people's need you. And so that draws you into your activity, because that's what's in your space. This group of people, this situation, is Ishwara. And this Ishwara is asking you to do this, this, and this. So that's what moves you. Another way, the Ishwara, the situation itself, nobody's making a decision, nobody's asking you anything. The situation that you're in requires you to behave in a certain way, to do something. It's not about people. The other is most important to understand, because it's so beautiful and it gives you so much freedom if you understand this. It's swecha. Swecha means swaicha. It means your own desires that are coming up. The desires of the prarabdha karma also manifest in the form of desire. Those desires are what impels you to go forward. Your desires, you didn't ask to have that desire. You know, as you've been with your knowledge long enough, all these other things fall up, you have no interest in them at all. Then a desire arises that has some force. It's not something you can just get rid of. It's prarabdha born desire. And that desire takes you into the next. Mm-hmm. So it's either the desires that are rising in you, or from another person, or the situations the universe puts you in. That's the prarabdha karma, and that's what you find yourself relating to all the time. And then say, until you know it's all just prarabdha, because there's nothing really going on in your mind that needs this or needs that, you just take everything as being your free will. Like, what if I say, is it prarabdha or is it free will?
Yeah.
You know, which is it? You know? Until that's not a question, take everything as free will, and you do your dharma in the situation. You know? Is that desire come from me? Or does it come from my prarabdha? You know? Is that something that I'm manufacturing, or is it my prarabdha? If you don't know, then there's nothing wrong with having a desire. It just should not conflict with dharma. And so then your only thing, if it doesn't conflict with dharma, your only task in terms of shanti is, do you go forward fulfilling that desire, accepting the fruits of the desire of your action as with that prasada buddhi? And then the mind enjoys shanti. There comes a time where all of these kind of desires that I've picked up along the way, I need this and I need that, that all falls off over time because they don't really belong to you. They've been accrued along the way. They're not yours. And as you become more settled in yourself, you lose interest in them because they don't belong to you anyway. They have nothing to do with you really. Those things all drop off. And then you're just left with the prarabdha karma, which is in the form of your life and your environment. The environment, your life, the people in your life, that's all your prarabdha, that's all Ishwara. this body, mind, sense organs here is part of this prarabdha, that my prarabdha will be the part that I experience that I'm moving through. Right now we have a shared prarabdha. But in a few hours you'll be driving off that way and you'll be driving off that way. And your prarabdha will go this way and yours will go this way and mine will be, you know what I mean? But right now, this is shared prarabdha. This is all shared Ishvara. We're all in this together, and we all have different perspectives within it, but it's a shared prarabdha. It's really beautiful in that way. And so say for all of us, we all have that kind of karma yoga buddhi, even knowing about prarabdha. That's a huge thing, you know? And so as you go on living your life in the light of the knowledge, what I'm saying is so much of all this excess stuff falls off, and then you find that your mind is free to be with Ishvara.
It's just free to
be with Ishvara. The surrender which is knowledge. It's not like there's surrender and knowledge. They're one and the same. So surrender to Ishvara is knowledge of Ishvara. And then you're just living your life day to day, doing what is to be done, happy to be here. That's that cheerfulness. You're happy to be who you are, you know, and to deal with the challenges that are here. It's all Ishvara. That's that manasa prasadam. There's a natural peace, the natural peace or fullness of yourself, because you're not asking yourself or anyone else to be different. It's a huge thing. And everybody gets to be free around you because it's all right with you for them to be as they are. That's such a gift, you know. There's one great gift from Swamiji, if you were Swamiji. It's perfectly all right for you to be you. And then, is there any way I can help? But there's not, you know, you can't be you. I can't be happy if you're you. You're as you are, then I can't be happy. Well, that's not a very free situation. We don't like to be. That's very an insecure situation. It's not nice to be around. We're used to it. We're used to that until you experience something different. When you experience something different where it's absolutely fine, without even a thought, the possibility of another type of thought, it's absolutely fine for you to be you. And so what if you allow not only others to be as they are, but for you to be as you are? Swamiji writes about this in his commentary on this chapter, on this verse. What a tremendous, beautiful gift that is. Mm. And so the next one is that Saumyatvam. The Saumyatvam is that physical expression of happiness, the happiness or the peace or the prasada, that well-being that you feel inside. So the Saumyatvam is how that actually expresses for other people to appreciate it. And so Shankar uses this example in his commentary. He goes, if the sun comes in, this is his example, the sun comes into the room and he sees the father, and the father is looking at him with a raised eyebrow and not a very shanti on his face, right? He's looking at him sternly. Right? And so at that time, when he sees that raised eyebrow and the eyebrow and the stern look, the son also becomes a little apprehensive. Something is wrong, you know. But then the son does something or other, and all of a sudden the father's face becomes calm. His eyebrows go back into normal position, right? And there's a smile, gentle smile on his face. And so then when the son sees that, eyebrows normal, gentle smile on the face, then the son relaxes and feels, ah, everything's okay now. Okay, That's Samyutpun. Mm. Is when that expression, the physicalization of that inner expression. And so the other person, that's what the other person is experiencing. Mm. Right? They're experiencing your insights on your face. When you look at the murtis, like the Dakshinamurti or the Ganesha or Sarasvati, if you look at those murtis, you see that Samyutpun in the most beautiful way. The murtis are so beautiful to contemplate on, because even the carving of the murti, the carving of the face, all of that is so regulated by the Vedas. It has to be just so. At the very end, it's not till the end that they kind of put in the eyes. Mm-hmm. But, you know. Because that expression is the expression of Brahman. You know? It's that if Brahman were to take a form, what would the Samyutpun be of Brahman? That's what it is. That's why it's so beautiful to meditate on those murtis, on the gentle smile. It's just a look in the face that is so beautiful. And in fact, sometimes we do meditations where you make your face take on the form of the murti.
Mm.
The same type of gentle smile. You relax your face, relax your eyelids, and you let that little gentle half smile take place on the face. So that your face, that gentleness in the face is triggering the internal response. See what I mean? Like if you make your face really angry, then it can trigger that type of response. Or you make your face, but you make your face in this gentle murti in meditation, then it can, you can start to understand or to feel the ananda or brahman. Mm-hmm. See what I mean? So that's the Samyutpun. Really, every one of these that we're doing is the manasa tapas. Remember we did the vachika tapas of speech, and we did the sharira tapas. This is the manasa tapas. The next one is maunam. Maunam, we think of maunam often as just not speaking. But this is the manasa maunam. Maunam that belongs to the mind. And so you can think of that as the mind is not having any pressure to speak. When your person feels that they have to speak, it's because there's pressure. There's a pressure to speak. You can't hold your mind doesn't want to hold it. It needs to talk to somebody. It needs to tell somebody. It needs to speak. Maunam, in reference to the mind, is where in the mind there's no need to speak. That's a nice way to say it. The mind does not have a need to talk. The mind has no pressure, no need to talk. So the mind itself is quiet. The mind itself is enjoying maunam with no pressure to talk. So, this word pressure is really important. Next time, say, when say you feel hurt or something happens, whatever, notice that there can be a pressure. I'm saying this so that you start to understand what we mean by this word pressure. There's a pressure to talk. You've got to call somebody. You've got to talk to somebody about this. Because there's a pressure, you know, a need. There's a real need to talk, a need to express. Maunam, on the manasa level, is that pressure is not there. So the mind doesn't feel a need to talk. You know? It's really beautiful. And it's important. It's beautiful to understand this word pressure. So when you feel that pressure, you can label it. You can say, here's what Swamiji meant. I remember thinking that. Here it is. This is what he means by pressure. There's a pressure to talk. You know, there's the pressure is hard to control. Dhamma, you know, shama and dhamma. Dhamma is the ability to control that pressure, whether it be in terms of speech or in terms of action. But the ability to control the pressure that is there. Because the pressure wants to act. Dhamma is the one that says, no, you want to do this, but you're not going to.
Mm.
Right? That's Dhamma. So pressure in terms of vak, in terms of speech, you know. So when I'm controlling speech at kind of this level of speech, that's what we call manam. I'm not allowing myself to talk. But manam, in reference to the mind, is where the mind has no pressure, no need to talk. So that's very beautiful. Then atma vinigraha. Atma vinigraha is the general ability to, atma here is mind. So the atma vinigraha is the ability in all different aspects to bring about the antakarana shuddhi. All the different devices and all of the different ways we have to control the mind. And control, I don't mean that in a negative sense, but you should be holding the reins. The buddhi should be holding the reins to the mind. The buddhi should be able to say, this behavior is not the best for you, you know? Or this way of behaving, or this way of talking is not what I'm working toward. And so you have tools to be able to transform those behaviors or to transform those emotional reactions and whatnot. You have the tools that you need to do that. The utilization of those tools at the appropriate time is what we call atma vinigraha. And it means that you have the commitment to do that. Like, this is when we talk about antakarana shuddhi, purity of mind. Antakarana shuddhi means there's a commitment for me to do the work that is necessary to transform those areas in my mind that cause myself and others pain. Simple, really. But I have to have a commitment to do it, you know? And I think that that commitment is slow in coming. It comes at its own speed, at its own pace. You know, because we have a lot of obstructions in the way of really having that commitment. Where my commitment to that atma vinigraha is stronger than my commitment to handling the reasons for that pain externally. Like, this happened because you did this and you did that, or I didn't get this or I didn't get that, or you said this or you said that. And you behaved in this way, or you behaved in that way. And so the commitment is to try to rectify the situation out here, you know, or to denigrate others for their behavior, you know, because you're like this, I'm miserable, you know. And so how can, I mean, I've had my share of all of this. It's not like, I've had to learn all of this, you know, it's not like... it's not like some of us escaped and didn't have to go through all of this process of going from needing to fix everyone out here to needing to transform my own mind so that I can welcome the universe as Ishwara. So that's a lot of growth. It is a lot of growth, and it's its own process, because in this process of growth, we have to also gain a value for that growth. So it's not like you start out with even having a value for it, because the value is for fixing things out here, you know, and getting retribution in one way or another, or hating people because they're screwing up my life. And within Vyavahara, within this empirical reality, you can look at it that way. If this person would just get the hell out of my life, things would be better, you know? You know? But what if my value is, what if my value has changed from that to, if I feel that way about anyone, then that person becomes an object of my sincere sadhana, to the point that I will take that person, I will welcome them and walk around with them in my heart until there's no such feeling, because I don't care about fixing anything out here at all. It's only about the shanti in my own mind that can just allow Ishwara to be, and I can enjoy myself.
Mm-hmm.
So that I have that mind, right? That mind which is not perturbed by the creation. I can just be with the creation as Ishwara and do my best in every situation. That's not to say that situations are easy. They're very challenging. I mean, Bhagavan has made, being, say it like this, kind of anthropomorphize the whole situation. This game is the most challenging game that there is. It is not pretend. You know? The challenges are real. The things you have to master are real. Some of them are really hard. Some of them are, they're not easy. It's not like you're some superstar. You know, somebody's just a superstar and they come into this loka and everything is just so easy. There's just no problem. There are no real challenges. Well, this loka is not like that. That's Swarga loka. You know, that's a heaven. That's Swarga loka. That's not this loka. This loka is challenging. No matter what level of punya you're on, punya in terms of wealth, or punya in terms of power, punya in terms of beauty, punya in all of these different ways, the thing is all of those are continually threatened and there's always somebody who has more.
Yeah.
That's the thing. It can be way, way up there on the top, somebody's got more. Way up there in power, somebody has more power. Way up there in beauty, somebody has more beauty. Way up there in being the most handsome, macho guy on the planet, but then you start to get old. And the new guy comes up. It's endless. That's the problem. And no matter how exalted in other people's eyes your situation is, there's still people way above you and way below you. And even when you're down in the dirt, there's still people below you and there's still people above you. And there's still things you have and see things you don't have. That's it. It's all very, very relative. So all I'm saying is the challenges are real. And you ask anybody, just ask yourself, you know, has life been that easy for you? I don't think so. You know? There's been plenty of challenges. You know, and that's the nature of life. So what about when you stop saying, feeling sorry for yourself, for all of the hard, hard challenges that are there? You say, yeah, they're hard, really hard things. They're really hard challenges. And these are my set. In this life, this is my set of things that I need to be able to transform. For the sake of Antakarana Shuddhi, this is the set, and it's not at all that it's easy, because it just isn't. It's easy once you've transformed it, then it's not there anymore. But until you've done that work to transform it, it's hard. It's hard work. But what if you start to get into a whole different mindset around it, where you enjoy that work, because that's your work. That's the thing. At some point, it becomes your work. It becomes what you're doing. Antakarana Shuddhi becomes, it's not just the secondary thing that people talk about. You know? I want knowledge, and yeah, Antakarana Shuddhi. Right? But I want knowledge, and knowledge will take care of all that. Well, yes and no. A lot of things are very persistent. You can have knowledge, and that knowledge, the buddhi, will live with a mind that is not able to really enjoy that knowledge.
Mm.
Yeah. And so you can blow that off, and if you want to blow it off, then you can just have a mind which is not really able to enjoy the fruits of your knowledge. But after all, you do have knowledge, and you do. But you don't, for whatever reason, want to make that effort. I think eventually you do want to make the effort. I just think it takes some time. I don't think a person can, I don't think the mind will be happy with its unhappiness. And so the pravritti, the inclination to make those efforts to change, to overcome your own smallness, will keep nagging at you until you do it. That's been my experience. So eventually you do it, and along the way you take it more and more seriously. So one more. Bhavasam shuddhihi. Bhavasam shuddhihi is just an expression that means that your intention is pure. That there's no deceit or hypocrisy in your intention. In how you are with other people, what your plans are, there's no hypocrisy or deceit. That the intention is clean. Your decisions are clean. What you are presenting to be done, the intention you're presenting is the intention you're presenting. Mm-hmm. And it's clean, and it's for the well-being of yourself and others. The asam shuddhi means that the intent is murky. The intent that other people are thinking is happening is not the intent that you really have. See what I mean? Mm-hmm. There's hypocrisy and deceit. So that bhavasam shuddhi means your intention is pure and clean. And the intention that other people think is your intention is your intention. Okay. Unless they're projecting something bad on you. Mm-hmm. What I mean is that the deceit's not coming from you. So that's the bhavasam shuddhi. So he says, iti eta tapaha manasam ichate. This is what we call the manasa tapas. So now, having said this, then this is what we'll do next week. Having said these three, sharira, physical, the bodily tapas, vachika, verbal tapas, and manasa tapas, now we're going to look at these three types of tapas from the standpoint of sattva, rajas, and tamas. So a few more verses, and then we'll move on to the dhanam, the giving.
Move on to what?
Dhanam, giving. Oh. Giving's also another tricky one. You have to give properly, appropriately. Yeah. Just take a moment. Swasti prajabhyaripalayantam nyayena margena mahimaheshaha go brahmanebhya shivamastu nityam loka samastha sukhino bhavantu kale varshati parjanyah prithivi sasya shalini desho yam cho parahitah Brahmanasantu nirbhayaha Om sarve bhavantu sukhinaha Sarve santu niramayaha Sarve bhadrani pashyantu Ma kaschit dukkha bhag bhavet Asato ma sadgamaya Tamaso ma jyotir gamaya Rityorma Amitangamaya Om Purnamada Purnamidam Purnam Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vashishyate Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Shri Guru Pyo Namaha Hari Om Did he Rob's email? Because he's still having trouble. Yes, he was back at
doing Dharma, brain, but a lot of times I feel like knowing what the right thing to do is like a lot of agitation. Like if I don't know and I'm thinking about it a lot,
because you can't figure out what the right thing is. Yeah, that's a problem. That's why when that happens, that doesn't happen very often, but it happens. Because usually it's almost second nature what the right thing is, but these confusing times come up. So it says in the Mandukya, Swamiji often quotes this and talks about it, that when in doubt, and it's amazing that the Upanishad would say something like this, what it says is, when in doubt in terms of Dharma, meet with a wise person of your era, of your time. Because you can even say of your place and time, because Dharma is slippery. Like, it's not always obvious. Like, especially, I was saying, the one we're going to do next, Dhanam, giving, that's very slippery also. Because what giving, in some instances, can be bad for the person. Mm. Yeah. There's some things that you decide may not be good for that person at all. You know, so it can be confusing. And so when you come to a position like that, you need to talk to somebody, because you need an outside, somebody that you trust as a Dharmanisha, if there is such a person, you know, to gain, like, put two minds there to discuss it and gain some objectivity. Because it's not always obvious. Usually it is. But there's these important times when it's not. And then you'll worry about it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I always ask for Bhagavan's help also. Good time to pray. To get down to talk to somebody.
Right. Oh, just so many thoughts are going through my mind, and so many different kinds of questions I could ask, and then I get all like, mute, and I can't ask anymore.
Ask the one that's on top.
Okay, I had this experience when I was away this week. I'm driving down the road in a small town of Willits. Little town.
I know Willits.
So I'm driving down Commercial Street, going west. And I'm a little bit distracted, but basically I'm just totally have the right of way. And suddenly I realize that there's this child right in front of my car on bicycle. Mm. And I feel this bump, and then I realize the child is, I've hit this child. So of course I just get out of the car and run over to the child, and he's perfectly okay. He gets up and he shows me, oh, this little scar. You didn't do that. I had that before. I mean, and I wasn't looking. I didn't see you. I was looking the other way. I mean, he completely...
Yeah.
But... Oh.
No kidding.
No kidding. Bhagavan was there for me right then. And because it wouldn't have mattered whose fault it was if I hit him.
Yeah.
Wouldn't have made any difference. Then I'm saying, see that stop sign there? You gotta stop for it, because, you know, barreling down the road there. But I'm asking about Dharma in relation to this incident.
Yeah. Well, what's the Dharma question, though?
Well, I don't know. That's what I'm saying. It happened. It could have had a totally different result, a split millisecond.
Yeah, but I don't see it's a Dharma question. I think it's Bhagavan's grace question.
Yeah, right. Well, that's how I saw it. Like,
yeah.
Thank you.
That's some huge punya that you're not meant to
have that happen right then.
Yeah. Just grace. Thank
grace.
God.
Okay,
yeah.
So that's how I took it?
Yeah, that's how I would take it.
Okay, yeah, that's how I did take it. And I've been saying thank you continually ever since. And thinking of writing to my bicycle friends, teach your kids to stop at stop signs.
Very scary. Boy. I would take it as Bhagavan's grace. And also, you can look at Bhagavan's grace also as there is some papa involved, but there was also punya that overrode the papa. Right, because that was a very dangerous situation. So something there, that dangerous situation happened, but some punya saved it from being a calamity.
Calamity,
which it's that would affect everybody's life,
everybody, and mine forever, the rest of my life. You know, even if I just hurt him a little bit.
Yeah.
And then a question: is my peripheral vision good? Is there any way I could?
I'm so glad that you didn't have to, thank God.
That really means that any opportunity to do punya, you got to jump on it, right?
Well, I would say...
Like money in the bank.
You can look at it that way, but I would do, just think of Dharma. Just do your Dharma.
Okay.
Dharma is good. Everything's, if Dharma is at the highest, then... Dharma doesn't rule out pleasure. It just means that all pleasure has to come within Dharma, you know. And if there's a doubt, then choose Dharma. That's just a clean way to live in terms of antikarma shuddhi, in terms of having the buddhi and your value system being the one who is the karta. As long as there's doership there, that karta, the buddhi is the buddhi, and your values are the ones that that rules. Yeah. It's like that beautiful whole, you know, it's on the cover of the Bhagavad Gita so often is Krishna, you know, Arjuna being in the back seat of the chariot, and Krishna is the driver, right? He's the one that's holding the reins of the manas in his hand. The manas are the reins, and the horses are the sense objects, so the sense organs. And so Krishna, the buddhi, knowledge, is holding the reins of the manas, which are controlling the sense organs. And then Arjuna can ride nicely in the back. So you want your knowledge to be the buddhi, the one that's holding the manas. You know? The manas is what has all the turmoil, all of the raga, dvesha, all of the unconscious material. But for the buddhi to be able to hold the reins of the manas, you need the right tools. You need the knowledge, you need understanding, and you need to know how to handle your unconscious. You know, you need to understand dharma. There's a lot of things to understand to give the buddhi the strength to be able to hold that wild manas, you know, which is, it's just a wild man. It's just, it's all raga, dvesha, and unconscious material, and all of this stuff. You need to know how to be with it. That's why that Dakshinamurti, you know, in that Dakshinamurti in his pose where he has his foot on the Apasmara, on that little ego guy, you know, that Apasmara,
yeah.
But his foot is just gently sitting there on his butt, you know, holding the, and he's just that epismiles like that, you know, lying there. But Dakshinamurti, with all of his wisdom, so easily keeps him in his contained. Your buddhi needs to be able to contain, to hold the reins of the epismile. The epismile is wild. It doesn't have dharma, it doesn't have anything.
Wants to consume more.
Yeah, more. Yeah, okay. It's just a wild man. The dharma is the buddhi. That's where the knowledge is, the tools are, the vision is. And the manas needs to slowly be transformed, you know, and assimilated. And it's as the buddhi gains in strength, the Apasmara, the little wild man that there, becomes, it has its boundaries. It has boundaries. And it's contained, and so it can be handled and taken care of. Your unconscious is like that too, like the scars and wounds we have in the unconscious. And the buddhi, which is firm with its knowledge and kind. Like Swamiji, firm and kind. And then that Apasmara can be handled. It also trusts that the buddhi can handle it and knows what to do, knows how to take care of it.
Well, and you talk about transforming like, say, sadness or something like that. How, you can't just wish for a transformation.
I think that the best way to transform sadness and hurt is for the buddhi who has knowledge, but also has love, you know, can hold, depends on how old the one is that's sad. What if it's a little boy that's sad? Or a little child, an infant that's sad? A little infant needs to be, you need to be with that child patiently. A little boy, you have to be with him. You have to understand why he's sad. You know, you have to be able to listen. You have to be able to be somebody who cares. I think, you know, part of that thing with hurt and sadness that's so healing is for that one that's sad to be understood. To be understood. People don't understand you. If somebody really understands you, that's really, you feel loved.
And it's not so complicated that you can't understand.
No, because it's all pretty simple. It's all lack of love in one form or another. All forms of abuse, you know. All forms of abuse, it's a lack of love.
It's like on one level, actually accepting sadness is sometimes just being with it. Allowing it to be. And feeling sad. As opposed to trying not to and having a physical, at least in a physical,
to allow
resistance to it.
That's that welcoming.
Yeah,
that's right. And also, the other little piece of that, which I think you're saying, it's not enough to just feel sad. But the one who is sad needs to feel sad in the presence of one who cares. And so that's why I say, if you're welcoming, instead of sadness, and you're welcoming the sadness, if someone's there who's welcoming the sadness, if there's only sadness, then there's just reliving the trauma.
Mm-hmm.
If there's only hurt, you're just reliving the hurt. But if the one who's hurt is contained and welcomed by the self, or by the buddhi that's a voice for the self, then that's really healing. Just same with a child, if the child's feeling really sad, but they come to you with their sadness, then that sadness gets transformed, because there's a witness to it who has love, you know. But if the child is sitting there with sadness, then they're just sitting there with sadness. There's not any tools for transformation there. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's what you were saying, I think.
No, got you fixed.
Title piece. Yeah.
I have a question. That Atma Vinigraha,
mm-hmm.
It, some things are easy to have that commitment about, but then some things are more challenging, and it's, there are times when I feel that I'm more, like there's a range. Maybe I have that commitment to realizing that it's something, you know, that I can deal with without having to change the external world. Or maybe I'm just open to that as a possibility, but not quite ready to
mm-hmm.
do it. Or maybe it's not even, I'm unwilling to, or maybe not even present to.
That's
it
right.
As a possibility. There's all these, there's a whole spectrum of different, I guess, degrees of awareness and of it.
Totally. That's right.
Yeah.
That's how it is.
How does it kind of grow and develop?
Well, you know, if you look at the unconscious, for instance, as being layered, the easiest ones are on top. Right? So
the low-hanging fruit.
Yeah, the low-hanging fruit. But as the low-hanging fruit is taken care of, the buddhi gets stronger. And then the next fruit, the next ones, become handleable. And so I feel like when something's too big to handle right now, you just say that, okay, I'll do this, I'll get to this later. It's too much for me right now. I can't do it right now. I have a problem. I can't do it right now. It's okay. I'll take care of that one later. We've got these to work on. It's giving heaven being patient, you know? Like, what if you say, okay, I have all these problems. All of these have to be solved. Well, that's not realistic. The buddhi, I would say the psyche, it's like if you think of it, we even use this example, think of the psyche as a flower, like a rose bud, unfolding. And it has its own order to it. And so you work on the things that become present and immediate for you to work on. They're there to be worked on.
Like you said to Johnny, the thought that's on top, that, or the question that's on top.
Mm-hmm.
Like whatever's on top is what you...
Yeah. And, you know, I had some struggles of things that... But I just couldn't deal with them. They were betrayals of this or that, of things that hurt me in one way or the other, and I didn't know if they would ever be gone.
Mm.
I really didn't. But they're gone. But there were years when I didn't know that they would be gone. So that's how it is. That there's some things that you think, I'm never gonna outgrow this, or this is just gonna plague me for the rest of my life.
Yeah.
And you can feel that way, because it does feel that way, but that's not necessarily true. It's just, it's too far away right now. The solution to that, or the outgrowing of that particular thing, is too far away for you to see the light at the end of the tunnel right now. But there is a light at the end of the tunnel, and these things do go away, and they go away not because the evil deed goes away, or the evil person goes away, or the evil situation goes away, but the one who you are is no longer bound to that situation. It's almost like you outgrow the whole situation. So it's no longer, you're no longer held by it or suffer it at all.
What about things like, that, you know, they just seem like they're so real that you can't just shift it internally, and that's not going to solve the problem. It might help you better address the issue. But like to say, lack of money or something like that. Or, I mean, in this society, we need money to survive. I mean, you could end up on the street, I suppose, later,
yeah.
But it's not a good life.
No, it's not. When that kind of stuff, that's where I think Swamiji, even in this reading this time, Swamiji even talks a little bit about that. It's almost like Shraddha in Ishwara, and taking things a day at a time. Okay, well, today... He goes like this, today I have enough money to live. And then he breaks it down further. For this meal, I have enough food. I have enough food for this meal. And then the next thing, wow, I have enough food for this meal. And then you look at, and then when tomorrow comes, okay, I have enough for this day. You know? So you start instead of, because what happens is, especially when we don't have a lot of money, then the pressure becomes really much greater than if you have money in the bank, right? It's greater. But in a way, you can take that as a challenge, you know, to say, okay, let me try. Because what difference does it make? I could worry and be ripping my hair out about not having enough money. Or I could live day to day to day and do whatever is to be done each day. One way is a total misery, and the other way is not. And in either case, you don't have any money. See what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
But one is full of misery, and the other is interesting.
Doesn't seem very easy, though. That kind of misery is particularly difficult to let go of and move on. I mean, it's one thing to have frustrations and problems and with those, but that one... You know, I've experienced it enough that it's this gnawing thing inside.
I know.
it's not like coming from thoughts, it's coming from something much deeper.
Well, maybe you have to go in dialogue with that one that's so frightened. It's probably a little child. Or whoever it is, you have to dialogue with it. Hmm. And the other, so there, that's one thing where you're actually dealing with the little one inside who's scared, really scared. You know? And then the other thing is after you've done that type of work, I would bring in your knowledge. And then start dialoguing with your knowledge. And what does it mean? What does Ishvara mean? What are they talking about in Vedanta? What does Prarabdha Karma mean? What happens to the self? What happens to the jiva? What does it mean for the jiva to be part of Ishvara? And actually start thinking these through, not just so much in an intellectual way.
Mm-hmm.
There's intellectual understanding there, but there's also living what you know.
Mm-hmm.
Living what you know, like in India they used to make, before they would teach, they would tell their sishas, their students, somebody told this story a long time ago, say you're up in Rishikesh, the sishas are up in Rishikesh in northern India, say, okay, just put the clothes that you have on your back, walk to Madras, the southern tip of India, and come back. That'll take you about 3 years. And when you come back, you know, then we'll begin.
Wow.
Yeah. And the reason for it is to start understanding that you're part of Ishvara.
You'll be taken care of.
You'll be taken care of in one way or another. You know. I did that when I was young. I was about 18. I walked to Mexico and back. Because I had to know whether there was a God or not. Or if it was just... If there was a God, then I had to be able to see that I would, somebody would take care of me. That, you know, I don't know what I was thinking, but anyway, I went down, I don't remember my route exactly. I left from Santa Rosa.
Well, it's a classic rite of passage.
Yeah, it's a rite of passage, yeah, to go on some sort of a journey, you know, where you realize that you're part of an intelligent universe. That it's not just inert, that there's you're part of an intelligent being. And so you have to experiment with that in some way or another. Mm-hmm.
You know, I once had, when I was at the ashram, I had this great fear, so I went to Swamiji, and he sent me back to my room and told me to write. And it worked.
Yeah, to write. That's another way of getting in touch with the unconscious.
Is to write?
Yeah. It's a free writing.
Yeah.
Not thinking.
No.
You just write. Write whatever's comes to your mind. That's a really good way also to do inner child work or dialogue with different characters inside. And you can even dialogue with God that way by writing. Writing is good because it gives structure to the unconscious.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it holds it. It's like gives it bones or something. That's a good idea.
Then the irony is when money comes in, the expenses increase.
Yeah, it's true. I always know because of my karma that if I have any money accruing, that it's going to be spent on something. I just don't know what it is. That's why I don't be there very long. So it's needed for something. I mean, I've got something like that in my chart, and it's always shown itself to be true. Oh, I must need this money for something. Something's going to happen that requires its money, because otherwise I just have enough.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
I think I have that one, too.
What?
I think I have that one, too.
Yeah. You have to learn to enjoy it. You think, start looking at Bhagavan as the banker. And Bhagavan only gives money from the bank when you need it.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
You
need it for something.
Yeah, you need this money now. Here it is. At the moment that you need it.
Yeah.
But we like to have the bank here, you know? Like it's like saying, Bhagavan, put the money in the bank, the physical bank, so that I can actually see it there and that will help me. And he said, what? I'll give you the money. And whenever you need it. When you need it, it'll be there. You have to play like that.